Hello, welcome to the Beatles Books podcast with me, Joe Wisby. I'm joined for this episode by Debbie Gendler, who is here to discuss her book, I Saw Them Standing There, Adventures of an Original Fan During Beatlemania and Beyond. Entranced by the Beatles in late 63, Debbie meets with Brian Epstein regarding the first US fan clubs and soon finds herself in the audience for the Beatles' first Ed Sullivan performance. Debbie shares detail on these and many other brilliant stories, including an encounter with the lads themselves. Debbie Gendler, hello. Welcome to the Beatles Books podcast. How are you?
I'm fine, and thank you for inviting me onto your show, Joe.
Pleasure, Debbie. It's a pleasure. We're here to talk about your book, I Saw Them Standing There, Adventures of an Original Fan During Beatlemania and Beyond. And I've read, as you know, several fan memoirs, and genuinely, this is in the absolute top tier. Really, really interesting book. Lots about Beatlemania, lots about after Beatlemania. And we're going to talk about all of that, hopefully, in our conversation. My traditional first question is, what inspired you to write the book? You could have written this any time, really, in the last 25, 30 years, even. What's the story of you deciding to write this book now?
Well, I decided to write the book now because I felt, number one, I was approaching an age where it was do it now or forget about it forever. And exactly 10 years ago, I was fortunate enough to be included in Ron Howard's feature documentary on the Beatles. I did talking engagements because of it, as well as really going back to the Grammy Awards show in 2014, where I also did some talks. And I was at the Grammy Museum, and I was on a panel with four other gentlemen and myself, and they all were talking about their experiences, yet only one had ever met the Beatles. And I just thought, wow, it's time, because at the back of the auditorium at the Grammy Museum here in Los Angeles, a woman shouted out from the back row, "What about your book?" And I thought, yeah, maybe I should do a book. I had been thinking about it. I did have ideas in my head, but really never went through with it. And I never kept any notes for a book. The only notes I had were in my travel diary when I went to England in 1967. Otherwise, I had no notes. It was all in my head. And I heard that and I thought, you know what? Now's the time. So I started writing, and it took me 9 years because I put it down. I'd say, oh, I don't have enough time. But exactly a year ago, I thought, you know what? It's time now. If I don't do it now, it's forever lost.
You say it took you so long. Was it enjoyable to write the book? Did your relationship with the Beatles and your kind of story, I suppose, did it change over the course of those 9 years?
Very interesting question, because it did evolve, let's say, over the 9 years. When I started and how I wrote the book, because I only had one day a week to write it, really, because I had an active TV producing job. I'd wake up on a Sunday and I'd think, today I'm going to write about the producer of the Beatles movies, or I'm going to write about the DJ who felt he was the fifth Beatle. So after that, and then just talking to people and reading more and thinking about it, my relationship and what I wanted to write about in the book did evolve from just very factual to, I got into a little bit more making a commentary, but I really tried to hold back from that as much as I could, because I wanted the reader to make their own decisions. I mean, one fellow who read the book, he's a publicist, he read the book and he told me, he goes, halfway through, I felt like starting to root for you, because there were so many obstacles that I had to overcome not just in trying to meet the Beatles, but even years after accomplishing what I really wanted to do. He said he started to feel like, it was like Rocky, So my ideas of the Beatles did evolve as they also evolved as people, because boy, over the 10 years, you saw a lot of changes come about in everyone's lives.
So let's go back to 1963, if we can. The book makes clear that you discovered the Beatles before most of America. I suppose an obvious question, but how and when did they first enter your life?
It was just a wonderful experience that I had. Family friends had gone to England for a vacation, and I was living in New Jersey at the time. They took this trip, and when they came back, they didn't know what to bring me because I was 13 years old, and their daughter was my sort of semi babysitter. And she would religiously watch American Bandstand. So her parents thinking, oh, I watched American Bandstand, I must love music. So they went into this record store, and how I know the name, it was called Soho Record Center. They left the receipt with the album, and I'm glad they did. I was able to later identify the fan club, because attached to that was, if you love the Beatles, join their fan club. So they brought me back this album, and I looked at it and I thought, wow, are these the cutest four guys I have ever seen? And when I played that album, I like couldn't believe the music. It was beautiful to me. And I heard the Beatles and I heard their song and I looked at their picture and I immediately just loved them. But I ran into quite an obstacle. The next day, I brought two friends home from school to listen to the album and look at the album cover, and they didn't like them. And they left my house. Literally, they went to buy a pizza. I will never forget this. I was so upset. Like, how could you not love this music? So I needed to find friends who loved the Beatles. So tucked in with that receipt was a little clipping that I guess the friends picked up at the cash register. But it said, join the Beatles fan club, right to 13 Monmouth Street and join the club. That was the letter I wrote that started this 60-year appreciating the Beatles.
Did you have any inkling then that it would last that long?
No, I never considered that. I mean, at age 13, thinking beyond age 18 was like ancient. I remember eventually when I got involved in the fan club, the permanent director was 35 years old. And I thought, wow, how old was she to like love the Beatles? There was no inkling yet, but I knew, and my parents actually, and they played a very, very big part in my story, of course, because they enabled me to do this. I had no money, I had no cars. I didn't have the battle at home like so many people did. So I felt pretty confident, and I mean, never thinking that they would still be the way they are today. I mean, that was so removed. But I felt they had a legitimate place in music for sure.
One of the key parts of the book, I would say, a part of the book that just gripped me was when you went to the Ed Sullivan show and you watched the Beatles live in February 1964. Just a seismic moment in Western civilization, I would say. And you were there. You don't need me to remind you about any of that. So if we can talk a little bit about that now, how on earth did you find yourself in that theatre that day?
It's a sort of continuing story from right where I just left off with you, because I wrote this letter And I waited and waited to hear back from the fan club. I went away to summer camp and I write in the book where other girls tucked in their trunk cigarettes to smoke. Not me. I brought that Please Please Me album with me at the bottom of my trunk and I would look at it. Everyone bought postcards to send home, but me. I bought a postcard and I remembered the address of 13 Monmouth Street, London. I bought 3 5-cent stamps and I wrote to the fan club and I wrote in these big letters, "Remember me, Debbie Gendler, Oakland, New Jersey." And that's all I wrote and addressed it. Never heard anything when I finally got home until right at around Halloween. I came home from school one day and my mother was there anxiously waiting for me. And she held up a yellow telegram. She said, "You received a telegram today from a lawyer's office in New York City. They want to meet with you to discuss their plans for the Beatles coming to America, to call the office to set the meeting." So my mother said, "Oh my goodness," and blah, blah, blah. I said, "Please, please, please call, call." So my mom did phone and she spoke to someone in the law office. It was a lawyer, Walter Hoffer, who was Brian Epstein's first lawyer in the US. And it was at his office. And the day they wanted me to come was Veterans Day in the US. Well, we had a national holiday. My dad drove me to New York and I went to this office and I met Brian Epstein and Walter Hoffer. And of course, they saw I was just 13. But what they wanted to do is identify teens in the New York area to ensure that at different venues there would be fans to welcome the Beatles. As I left, Walter Hoffer's secretary called me over to her desk and said, "I want to make sure we have your name, phone number, address correct. Because if Mr. Epstein meets Ed Sullivan tonight and the agreement happens," so I know actually what day exactly this was, because later in the day, Brian was going to meet Ed Sullivan to confirm the appearance, "we will send you a ticket." And that's how I got my ticket to go to the Sullivan show.
Wow. What are your memories of that day? It must have been so exciting. The anticipation must have been just through the roof.
Oh, it was incredibly exciting. You know, here's the very girl thing I have to discuss. It was really important to decide what I was going to wear. It couldn't be anything. It was dressed up when you went to theater or a TV show. I chose what I was wearing. It was already a little cold, grayish Sunday, and my mom took me to New York. We parked, and the battle began after parking. We started walking along 51st Street, it was, over to Broadway, and there were already groups of kids running up Broadway. And we had to sort of fight our way in a bit. We got stopped by a New York City police officer on a horseback. My mom admitted to being 5'2", and she's looking up at this police officer on this horse and trying to show my ticket that it's legitimate. She finally pushed me through to the barricade after I got clearance from the police officer, and I went into the windy vestibule. They pulled my ticket from me, literally pulled, and I said, "Please, I want to keep it. I want to keep it." And they said, "No." So I gave it in, and then I was directed up the staircase to the mezzanine on the left. I was upset that I saw people entering and going directly to the orchestra level, but I was just happy to be there and kindly went upstairs and took a seat. By the time I sat down, I had gone with a mindset that I was going to be very grown up. I thought, if a Beatle sees me, maybe I could go to England too one day. Anyway, I took my seat. the gal behind me was already like jumping up and down in her seat and having a good time. But I said, I'm going to be adult-like. That was until the Beatles amazingly appeared. Ed Sullivan did the introduction. And one of the last things I remember before the Beatles coming on stage is there was a television monitor mounted up, and there was a commercial on for the aspirin Anacin. And there was so much screaming going on in the theater. My final thought was, boy, those camera guys are sure going to need that Anacin before the Beatles come on, because it was the screaming and the excitement and the anticipation. And then Ed Sullivan introduced the Beatles. They came on, and I will forever, forever remember that moment. Suddenly, all my loving started. The Beatles looked like they were having such a good time. And then I was so happy for my seat, because instead of looking straight out to the audience, where their views from the stage were obscured by a lot of cameras, they were looking up to the mezzanine. And that was great, because we were sort of overhanging a little bit, and then they looked at us. And it was just an amazing experience, but it was over instantaneously. It was so fast.
So my dad was born in 1948 and fell in love with the Beatles in 1963 when he would have been 15. And he said, one thing about in the UK is some people got into the Beatles during the first album, when they were touring, when they did the Royal Variety, when they did the Palladium show. So people fell in love with them at different points in the UK over 63. Apart from exceptions like yourself, in America, it was all that one moment, pretty much everyone that night in February felt the same thing. Do you think that that has a different effect about how people see the Beatles in America and in the UK?
I absolutely do. And that's a really interesting question. I suffered a lot of ridicule in school for loving the Beatles. After that night, and a few of my friends knew I was going to even see them at the Ed Sullivan show. And they were excited and said, you have to come back on Monday morning and tell us all about it. But there were a lot of people who had zero interest. I came to school that Monday, and I gotta tell you, I was my own rock star in the school. The vice principal came up to me. I was scared, because the vice principal in American schools, they tend to be the disciplinarians. So when I saw this guy approach me, I got really scared. And he goes, oh, no, don't be worried. He goes, could you please bring that album of yours from England to school tomorrow? Because there were so many people in my small town in New Jersey that didn't yet have access to meet the Beatles. They wanted to hear an album. They wanted to hear the music. All of a sudden, it was madly, madly Beatlemania. I remember girls bringing their notebooks and on a piece of paper writing Beatles, 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 all on the paper, all across, on their palms of their hands. I mean, it was overnight. It's the New York media, especially, that emanated it out, and then followed by newspapers and radio stations. But then they started to manufacture Beatle magazines. Articles were syndicated on them, and the whole thing just exploded. So, whereas I think that in the UK and in Europe, you had a more flowing rollout of the Beatles. We were in one night with 73 million people. You know, there were only 191 million people in all of the states, and 73 million of those were watching the Ed Sullivan show that night. I mean, it was just unbelievable. We got clobbered by the Beatles in one night. And people say, why? Oh, they look to the Kennedy assassination and say, oh, America was depressed. And oh boy, having lived it, because at age 13, my memory is pretty good for that age. We were depressed. For teens like me, well, everyone, it was like, how could we have experienced this and seen this? Yeah, did the Beatles bring us a sudden amount of joy? They sure did. But I don't think it was just solely because of the Kennedy assassination. They brought with them a new energy, a new look. And as I said earlier, the music industry before was in a pretty much a slump, and they brought a great sound with them.
Another remarkable day in your book, in your life, is your experience at the Warwick Hotel at the Beatles press conference the following year in 1965, August 1965, which is a really gripping part of the book. You find yourself in a room with the four Beatles again. Tell us how you managed to arrange that.
Well, I just love these guys. And I resolved, you know what? I needed something big in my life and something major to do to help me in this small New Jersey town. And I thought, the Beatles are it. I knew that they needed a fan club after what had happened at the Ed Sullivan Show. And I called Evelyn Klein, the secretary, who said, give me your name and address. And I said, is there a fan club for the Beatles? And she said, right here, there is. They ran in the initial years the fan club right out of a supply room at Walter Hoffer's law office. She goes, why don't you come over? So I did. And I'd say it was probably late February, maybe around President's Day when we had a day off from school. And I went over and, I met the people working at the fan club, just random people answering letters. But I don't think anything was really established until March when Beatles USA Limited, the official fan club, really began operations there. I got involved in the club, and obviously Brian knew who I was, and I made myself known to the other people. So I was always welcome to stop by. They started fan club chapters, official chapters all across the country, as well as there were unofficial fan clubs that a group got together in a school and said, we're starting our own fan club. So there were many ways to go. I started to go to the official club. One of my visits there, I overheard that they were going to allow a fan club chapter president to meet the Beatles, to welcome them to America. I had done, on behalf of the official fan club in 1964, I had done local New York television. I had given interviews because, as I said, they sort of knew me. So I did all those things. But I heard that one is going to be selected and it's the tour promoter. So who is the tour promoter? Someone that I had already met, Sid Bernstein. And Sid Bernstein was going to make the selection. I was like, oh my goodness, he knows me. I went to the director of Beatles USA Limited. Her name was Bernice Young. I said, Bernice, how can I get to be chosen? What do I have to do? She said, Sid Bernstein, he's making the decision. Contact him. And I said, and can I get tickets to go see the Beatles at Shea Stadium? And she goes, yes, contacts it for the whole thing. So I did. But not trusting in the adult world anymore, I went and, like everyone else, ordered the maximum four tickets to Shea Stadium anyway. And I wrote Sid, but I didn't hear anything back. I spent an excruciating 2 months. Just everything waiting for that letter. And fortunately, it did come. So I got to go to the Warwick Hotel as a guest of Sid Bernstein. I also got for tickets from him as a guest to go to Shea Stadium. So it was really my joy. I just gave 4 tickets to members of my chapter. One of those gals wrote me and still is thanking me for the greatest opportunity she ever had by getting one of those tickets and being able to go to Shea Stadium.
So take us back into that room then. There aren't many people that I've ever met that have been to a Beatles press conference. So I have to ask you, they always look like chaotic, hot affairs. What are your memories of being in there?
Well, it was chaotic. It was exciting waiting for them to arrive from the airport. They flew to New York City. This was August 13th. They left London Airport. They got to JFK Airport, limo to the Warwick Hotel, upstairs to their suite on the 33rd floor. And in 20 minutes after their arrival, they were brought down to what was called the Warwick Room on the mezzanine of the hotel. I was seated in a front row until those pushy New York press people came in and started to bring in equipment and themselves and sit down right in front of me. Also, to my right, I suddenly saw coming someone I recognized. He was Cousin Brucey, the DJ on WA Beatlesy. I was so excited to meet him. I introduced myself. He was friendly as could be. I gave him my autograph book to sign, which he did. He felt great about that. And then the Beatles suddenly came out. Asking questions was this woman from WCBS, Tony Barrow behind her, and Cousin Brucey, who I thought was my friend, he too took an elbow and hit it right into my right rib to get out of the way. I mean, this was a guy who was nice to me 5 minutes before, but he told me to get out of the way. And so I didn't know what to do, and I couldn't see really the Beatles as well. So I stood up. I was near the end of the row. So I stood up there, being able to look at them. I had my camera with me, a Brownie Instamatic 300, which I still own. And there were cartridges then, drop-in cartridges that had only 12 pictures. You also had to use flash bulbs. There were wires on the bottom. I was doing it so quickly, I cut myself on one of the wires from the flash bulb. I started bleeding there, but I took away the pictures. Two of my pictures that I took are in the book, as well as one picture of me that I was able to find of me standing at the press conference, standing there just looking at the Beatles. It was brutal. The press were brutal, and the questions were dumb. I mean, just really, really dumb. So much so that this was 1965. I mean, I was already 15 at this point. Seemed dumb to me. Afterwards, it was over. The Beatles were let out to the freight elevator. The New York press cleared out. I've never seen anything empty out as fast. And I was told, remain in your seat. We will come and get you to bring you upstairs to meet the Beatles. So I sat in my seat. I was all alone. And I looked over my shoulder. There was nothing in the back. It was totally quiet. But there ahead of me on the table was all the Beatles things that they use. A napkin, Ringo's cigarette package that he had twisted, a glass that Paul McCartney drank out of, the napkin that George used. I mean, it was all out there. And I thought, whoa. Okay. Cousin Brucey was really pushy. And I thought, if I don't do something and add this to my Beatles collection, I will go through life forever upset that I didn't take these items. So when no one was there, I quickly took my bag, opened it up, and I put in the ashtray with the cigarette butts. I put the napkin in. I got to the glass, and then I sort of heard someone, and there was about, I'd say about an inch of water left, and I didn't know where to empty it. You could hear like the door beginning. I said, "Oh, who cares?" And I just threw the glass into my bag and sat down. And the gal said, who worked for Sid Bernstein, said, "Come on, time to go up." So they had given us all a press packet with stills and things from help. So I picked it up from my seat and went upstairs with her. When I got up, there was a huge commotion. I thought, oh God, what is this? I got let out and told, please stand over here, the elevator. And it was a commotion with a New York City police, hotel security, and some other men. There was a girl who had climbed up on the fire escape to the 33rd floor, crying hysterically, wanting to come in. At that point, there was big discussion. George Harrison came from around the room, heard what was going on, and said to one of the officers, let her stay. And the security person said no, because if all the people below suddenly hear, she'll go down, start screaming, we'll have nonstop people climbing up. So they led her back to the freight elevator, and they then told me, you can go ahead into the suite. And I went in, and there were the Beatles, including a lot of other people, radio DJs, Brian Epstein off on the distance, Tony Barrow, a couple of other people, British accents, Andy Warhol standing next to Brian. That was so exciting to see him. And I was introduced first. There was George because he was closest to the door. And it was sort of like he knew me already because he had seen me standing there, like, hi, hello, whatever. Paul next, very friendly, very friendly. They were all like so happy to be there, I think. Then I got to John and I was there and I was ready to shake hands. And John wasn't looking at me. He was looking down at the floor. He says, what's that? And out of the corner where the bag was stitched was dropping water that was sort of yucky with ashes from the ashtray dropping onto the carpeting in the suite. And he goes, what's that? And I said, oh, and I was ready to just collapse. Couldn't believe it. He goes, come here, open up your bag. And he made me stand there and he looked into the bag. He goes, this is rubbish. And I said, it's for my memorabilia collection. He goes, no, this is rubbish. And I said, it's precious to me. It's rubbish. Ringo, seeing all this, just sort of shrugged his shoulders. And I can honestly say, I really didn't meet him for the rest of the time. He was there, I was there, but there was no whatever. And I was absolutely devastated by this meeting with John. I got saved, though, by a sandwich because at that moment, these big, giant roast beef and turkey sandwiches with coleslaw and Russian dressing on rye bread arrived from a deli. And one of the people there said, stay and have a sandwich. It was already probably 6, 6:15, and they were still wearing their same clothes that they had traveled in from England. And so I went and I sat there and I ate a part of a sandwich because I just didn't know what to do. And I didn't know how to get out of there because how could I say? No one approached me to bring me downstairs or anything. It was just this happened. I got made fun of and I was devastated. And so I sat and I ate my sandwich At the end, Cousin Brucie was up there and brought all four Beatles into an adjoining suite, which looked like one of the bedrooms there. And they were all seated around, and Cousin Brucie had a microphone in his hand, getting ready to interview them. And I figured, okay, I went in, I need to leave. So I went in and I sort of knocked before, and the Beatles were sitting there, and Cousin Brucie and I said, goodbye. Thank you very much for inviting me. And Cousin Brucie turned to the Beatles and said, she's a doll, isn't she? And I'm thinking, are you kidding? You were the guy who downstairs 40 minutes ago or so was beating me up. And I walked out sort of from the doorway into the room. Neil Aspinall was there. I got escorted down in the freight elevator by Neil, and he pulled out of his jacket a copy of A Spaniard in the Works. And he goes, this is from us for your collection. And that's how I left. That was my day of meeting the Beatles.
One of the best stories. Terrific story. Thank you for sharing that.
And I still have all the trash, by the way, Joe.
Good.
I still have the napkin, the ashtray, and the cigarette thing. As a matter of fact, I put a picture of the cigarette in the book.
Brilliant. There are lots of other adventures that you have in the 60s with the Beatles, but I'm interested to talk a little bit about how you also have these encounters with two Beatle wives, Yoko and Linda. Can you tell us a little bit about them? I imagine they were dramatically different characters. Can you give us a little sense of what they were like?
Okay, I'll start with Yoko first. I was working on a television show called The Home Show. It aired across America on ABC television, 1 hour every day, Monday through Friday. It was geared to women. I had read that Yoko was looking to celebrate something for John and his birthday and play Imagine around the world and the United Nations was going to be tied in where she would address a group at the UN and then at a designated time, like 12 noon New York time, but all around the world, everyone would play the song Imagine. I read about it and I went to our producers and they said, sure, go ahead and do it. So I got in touch with Yoko and then I got in touch with Elliot Mintz, who lived here and still does in LA. And I knew him already from all things that I had done with Mike McCartney, setting up photography exhibits and the party at my house. And so I knew several of these people. And it ended up that I did this remote. I flew to New York and did this with Yoko. I have to tell you that I hate to admit it, not crazy about Yoko. I was not her fan. I came away from doing the production her fan. And I changed my mind about her completely. She wasn't difficult. She was wanting it done in a certain way. So the pre-planning with Yoko on the phone that I did, and then the day of actually working with her, we did it on October 8th. Not the 9th, it was a live satellite from a studio in New York. So that by the 9th, because our show would air in certain areas, it would be past the 12 noon of New York time. We did it the day before so everyone could participate on October 9th. She was really wonderful to work with. She realized that I was there to do a good job. I wasn't looking at her like trying to belittle her, find out, oh, did you break up the Beatles? You know what? That was not on my agenda. We were there to honor John Lennon on his birthday and let other people know to do the same. And it was really a wonderful collaborative experience that I had. And for many years, and I mean many, every year at holiday time, I received a holiday card from Yoko and Sean. I have a collection of them through the years that are very, very precious to me. So that's my Yoko working experience. And I called her a few times afterwards. She was always willing to talk. Never did I feel rushed. Okay, now I'll go over to Linda, which was a very different experience, but a really, really wonderful one as well. I produced Linda twice. It was in coordination with her cookbook. Now, whereas I hadn't met Yoko prior to this, I had met Linda. So we sort of had a bit of a prior knowledge. I don't want to call it even relationship because that's stretching it. We knew each other already before. It was really a fun experience for me because it was a food related segment that we were doing, and actually two segments back to back. I got the show to increase her time on camera. So I had information and I had her phone number. Linda and I on the phone decided what recipes she would be making. I had to go about and find a person in New York City who would cook it. She had to be a vegetarian kitchen because Linda would not even entertain having a non-vegetarian kitchen prepare the food for her. But her biggest thing was I get a phone call from her. It was in the middle of the night here in LA, and it was Linda who said, "Hey, Deb, I'm sitting here and I just want you to know." When she's looking at the script, she goes, "I have to call meat dead flesh." So I said, "Dead flesh." She goes, "Yeah, that's what meat is dead flesh." This was a morning show on network television. Anything dead did not go over well. So I had to get special clearance. The producer of the show said, "This is your battle. Go to our standards and practices of the network to figure out how to handle this." So I did. They're called standards and practice, but they're really the censors. So I did. I went to battle, and I will never forget the joy I felt when I received a phone call back at work about 3 days later, approved. So I called Linda. She was at home at her farm. I remember she was making dinner and I said, "Approved." She goes, "Our victory, our victory." I mean, she was so happy about being able to say dead flesh. You have no idea. So she came to New York. We did the segment. She was happy with it. And that was promoting the first cookbook. And then we did it again for her other cookbook a couple of years later. I mean, she was wonderful to work with. The only thing is that she wanted to use TVP, textured vegetable protein. And before I left LA, and I don't know how this happened, at work one day, I got a phone call from Archer Midland Daniels, the manufacturer of TVP. They wanted me to carry 25 pounds of TVP to Linda McCartney as a gift. I said, "There's no way." I said, "I can bring 3 pounds if you send it to my hotel in New York," which they did. So I did carry 3 pounds of TVP to Linda. But I have to tell you, she was very professional, wonderful to work with. She promoted her book beautifully. No, Paul did not come to the show. Everyone always asked me, "Oh, did he come?" I said, "No, but Mary McCartney did." She actually helped me run cue cards for Linda because we spent part of the morning rehearsing and what she wanted to say and things like that. So it was lots of fun. And I saw her several times after that. And sometimes in one very per actually twice in very personal settings. And every time she goes, We beat that network, didn't we? Dead flesh. She never forgot it.
Brilliant. Well, Debbie, there's so much more that we could talk about, but I want to leave it for readers to find out in the book. Genuinely a brilliant story. So all that's left really is for me to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for inviting me onto your show. And it's a true pleasure, Joe.